From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, it's considered Detroit's largest art object. Now, the Fisher Building's on the auction block.
If you don't put bodies in those suites, then you have a hard time paying the bills, paying your bank note.
How did the debate over climate change get so toxic?
It has become a debate over values. It's really not about science anymore. It's not about CO2 and climate models.
Teens in trouble, texting crisis lines.
I feel like it's easier to write things down than it is to speak it sometimes.
And the winter majesty of Lake Superior's sea caves.
Everything from tiny icicles with hoarfrost on them to massive ice columns and frozen waterfalls coming off the top of the cliffs.
Those stories and much more on Stateside. The average teenager sends some 2,000 text messages a month. That's an average. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, why teen crisis centers are partnering with the first and only crisis hotline to conduct its interventions totally by text. But first, a bill that would require cell phone carriers in Michigan to release location information to police during an emergency seemed good to go in the state house. And then came pushback from several lawmakers. MLive's Capitol reporter Jonathan Osting has been following House Bill 4006. Fill us in, Jonathan.
It's sponsored by State Rep Kurt Heise out of Plymouth Township. And what it would do is require wireless cell phone carriers, so, you know, your Verizon, your AT&T, to disclose location information in the case of an emergency. So this bill is, it's been passed in other states. It's based on a case in Kansas where a young girl was abducted and unfortunately murdered, and her family had a very hard time, and law enforcement had a very hard time trying to track her location using her cell phone. That information is available, but her wireless carrier wouldn't disclose it.
So the idea was, okay, then in case of something like this, they have to.
Yeah, exactly. In limited cases where the legislation specifically mentions that someone's life may be in imminent danger.
And it looked as though the bill was teed up and ready to get voted on by the House until?
Until late last week, a couple of freshman lawmakers, actually, Todd Corser and Cindy Gamrat, who are sort of Tea Party favorites, brought up some privacy concerns. And I think that is kind of a logical concern with a bill like this, because it would allow police to obtain information without a warrant. So a couple potential amendments that Corser and Gamrat are looking at. One of them would require a law enforcement agency to at least tell somebody if their cell phone location information had been disclosed. They'd have to give them a notice within 48 hours. And Gamrat also actually wants to require warranting. Some lawmakers say that with the use of modern technology, it doesn't take days to obtain a warrant anymore. It can take hours, and they'd like to see that actually built into this legislation, which seems like if there's one issue that's going to hold up a passage, it could be that warrant issue, because the whole point of the bill, I think, is to be able to do this without a warrant.
And the ACLU had some concerns as well, didn't it?
Yeah. The ACLU, this legislation actually came up last year in a previous form, and the ACLU, was seeking a number of amendments and won a handful of them. For instance, they want there to be a clear punishment for law enforcement personnel if somebody does use this ability for personal gain. So if somebody, accessed location data or requested it without there actually being a legitimate emergency. So that was one of the things they wanted. They're also supporting this idea of a 48-hour notification. So again, to let somebody know if their cell phone had been pinged within 48 hours of it happening.
And what you just said is important to understand, right? It isn't reading text messages or checking into Facebook accounts. It's pinging cell phones. So it's basically, what, using the phone like a GPS?
Exactly. And Kurt Heise, the sponsoring representative for this bill, is very clear about that. You know, nobody's going to be reading text messages. As you mentioned, it would simply provide some coordinates to law enforcement officials so they could, track down somebody who might be missing in these limited emergency situations.
Jonathan Osting, MLive Capitol reporter. Thanks so much, Jonathan.
Thank you for having me.
One of the greatest skyscrapers in Detroit is on the auction block. The Fisher Building and its next-door neighbor, the Albert Kahn Building, have fallen into foreclosure as they struggle with fewer and fewer tenants. Let's find out more now as we say hello to Dan Austin. He's with the Detroit Free Press, and he runs historicdetroit.org. Hey, Dan.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. We have heard so much buzz about Dan Gilbert buying up downtown office buildings and buzz about Midtown Detroit. I got to say, I think some of us were taken by surprise to see your story in the Free Press and learn the Fisher Building will be auctioned off. What has led to this?
Yeah, what we're seeing is that the prosperity that is happening in Midtown and downtown has yet to translate to New Center. You have a lot of development going on up there, but it's almost all Henry Ford Hospital. The office rates have been steadily declining as either people relocate downtown or Midtown, whatever is trendy, leaving behind these giant buildings. I mean, the Fisher, you look at it and it's huge, you know, 700,000 square feet of space, and some of those available or empty suites are, you know, 20,000 square feet. So there's a lot of room, and of course, if you don't put bodies in those suites, then you have a hard time paying the bills, paying to keep all of that beautiful plaster and all those ornate decorations in good shape. I mean, it's running a building of this size is not easy.
It is such a gem. In fact, put on your historic Detroit.org hat for us, Dan Austin. For those who haven't seen the Fisher Building, can you begin to describe this building, the lobby, the Golden Towers?
Man, I don't know whether words can even do it justice, but it is probably Detroit's second greatest example of what we now know as Art Deco architecture, behind only the Guardian Building. And let's be, you know, fair here. It's not many buildings in the country can touch the Guardian, but it's one of very few National Historic Landmarks in Detroit. It's covered in limestone and marble with sculptures all over the place. The interior, man, how can you even describe it?
I know.
It's so beautiful. I mean, you have at least three-story kind of an arcade with beautiful hand-painted ceilings, all sorts of eagles and cherubs and other things. There are mosaic tiles. The colonnade is lined with 40-something kinds of marble from all over the world. I mean, it is considered Detroit's largest art object, is what they call it. And if you haven't been there, I don't care whether you live in Grand Rapids or the UP, it's almost worth the trip to Detroit just to take in the beauty of the Fisher Building.
So it's important to understand that the conditions are good.
Yeah, both of them, yeah. Mm-hmm. Both of them, I wouldn't say that they're perfect. Like I said, sometimes some maintenance is a little behind on maintenance on restoring some of the painting and plaster work. But, I mean, all in all, I mean, they're incredibly intact. And I think that everyone I talk to, as far as real estate speculation is concerned, said that, you know, if you can find somebody who is willing to invest money in New Center, kind of become the Dan Gilbert of New Center, then they're going to do extremely well. There has not been a Dan Gilbert type of figure or a Pete Karmanos or even a Mike Ilitch in New Center. And once General Motors moved out of its headquarters in New Center to the Renaissance Center, you know, there's not been that corporate caretaker, if you will. There needs to be someone who's going to come in and make a big stance.
Yeah.
And I think that Fernando Pelzuelo, his name has been thrown around a lot in the press with his big splash he made on the Packard plant. He made it clear that he is interested in both the Fisher and Albert Kahn. He tried to buy them from Fardman, which is the entity that lost it in foreclosure. So if someone like him can come in and make that big play, that big splash, New Center is poised for some great things in the near future.
Dan, I have to say, some of us were rather caught off guard by the whole process. Here you have one of the most beautiful Art Deco buildings in Michigan, if not the nation. And it's going up on auction.com, which to me seems like kind of the way you'd sell an old car.
Yeah, and we've actually seen this an increasing amount here in Detroit. In fact, as we talk right now, they just closed an auction.com auction for the Bankers Trust Company building downtown.
Huh.
It's a smaller building, absolutely gorgeous, designed by the same architect who did the Guardian building and the Penobscot, actually. But the David Stott building and the Free Press building were both sold online in auctions. I mean, I don't know, I go on eBay to buy old records and things like that, but I never would think to go online to buy a building. But this way, you know, that's how the Chinese company DDI wound up buying the David Stott and the Free Press building. You know, I guess it's finding more potential buyers worldwide for some of these properties. I don't know whether it's a good thing or a bad thing, but regardless, I mean, you have a lot of buildings changing hands, more so in recent months or even the last couple of years than probably in the last decade. I mean, you know, it used to be an old Detroit before the latest Renaissance that someone would buy a building and then just sit on it for 10 years. Maybe he or she would pay the taxes, maybe not.
Maybe not.
But now buildings are being, especially with Dan Gilbert buying up, you know, half of downtown. I mean, buildings are changing hands at an insane amount, and you know,
is that a good thing? Is that a good thing? Do you think?
I think it's a good thing if the buildings are going to the hands of someone who's going to do something with them. I mean, if someone's buying the building up and they're planning on getting to work, yeah, it's great. But if they're just going to buy it up and speculate and sit on it for a while, kind of like the previous owner of the Free Press building and David Stopp building did. And those buildings sold to Florida developer a while ago. He didn't do anything with them. And now he sold them to someone else, and they're not doing anything with them that we can see anyway. So I don't know.
It's not easy
renovating some of these buildings.
No.
Or cheap. I mean, that's financing for some of these buildings, and tax credits are involved. I mean, it's an incredibly complicated and expensive process on bringing an abandoned building back to life.
Dan Austin with the Detroit Free Press and also historicdetroit.org. Thank you so much, Dan.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Okay, granted, there has certainly been a lot to grumble about this winter. But let's take some time to celebrate one of winter's gifts, the sea caves at Apostle Island's National Lakeshore, 18 miles west of Bayfield, Wisconsin. That's where Old Man Winter has teamed up with Lake Superior to create a natural art gallery. Neil Houck is with the National Park Service at the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore on Lake Superior, where he is Assistant Chief of Interpretation and Education. Neil, these sea caves are here all year round, but what's making them so incredibly special right now?
Well, the sea caves are beautiful all year round. They're formed in a cliff of 60-foot high cliff of reddish sandstone. And so any time of the year, it's fun to walk the trail above the cliffs or to paddle a kayak through the caves. But what makes them special this time of the year is that all of that gets bedecked with amazing diversity of ice formations, everything from tiny icicles with hoarfrost on them to massive ice columns and frozen waterfalls coming off the top of the cliffs.
So the polar vortex that we've been complaining about really was a gift, right? Because it froze Lake Superior enough to let people walk out to see all of this beauty?
That's right. It's not every year that Lake Superior freezes sufficiently to walk on it. And we went through a period of 4 years in a row where there was never enough ice for people to visit the caves. So now this makes 2 years in a row where we have had enough ice to support the weight of all the people that are walking out to view this natural wonder.
I'm wondering, how do you decide when to give the green light? How much ice do you need?
Well, because of all of the people that are out there, we're fairly conservative in determining how much ice is necessary. But the ice all along the path that people walk has to be at least 10 inches of solid ice. And the ice shelf has to extend at least 2 miles offshore. It has to extend for about 8 to 10 miles along the shoreline. And the ice shelf has to be in place for about at least 2 weeks before we will open it up. It's just that we have seen conditions break the ice shelf up and blow it away in a matter of hours. And so we want to be sure that it's stable before we send hordes of people out on it.
And speaking of that, what kind of reaction are you getting from the public? How many visitors are you getting on a given day?
Oh, it's fantastic. In 2009, when the caves were open for 2 months, we had a total of 8,400 people came to visit the caves at that time. Since we opened on Saturday, we've had nearly 15,000 people who've walked out to the caves.
And I think probably the difference is internet and social media, isn't it?
That's a big part of it. Certainly the national news coverage has helped as well, but I'm sure that a big part of it is the fact that so many people are sharing their fantastic photographs of the ice caves that really stoke the fires of people's interest.
Now, these folks are determined, aren't they? Because they're not just hopping out of the car and walking up to a sea cave.
No, this is not your basic stroll in the park. This is a walk out on the frozen surface of the lake, which this year is extremely slippery in some places and extremely rough in others. We're encouraging people to wear some sort of ice cleats on their shoes to prevent falling. And you have to walk for at least a mile across the lake to get to where the cliffs begin, and the cliffs extend for 2 miles. And if you're one of the unlucky folks who arrives in the middle of a very busy day, you may not be able to park within 2 miles of where the trailhead is to start walking out on the lake. So it's miles of walking, but you know, it's certainly well worth the effort.
Well, the Detroit Free Press posted a video, a very, very nicely done video, and I was so struck by not only the beauty of these ice formations, these spectacularly long icicles that look like huge stalactites and these chandeliers of ice and frost, but the reactions of the people. They're joyful.
Yes, it is. You know, it helps if it's a nice, warm, sunny day when people are out there and not sub-zero wind chill. But yeah, people are giddy in some cases. And you mentioned the works of art during the introduction, and that's exactly how somebody explained his experience to me. He said it was like going to the Metropolitan Museum, and everywhere you looked, you saw something more spectacular than what you had just seen.
And I'm sure as someone with the National Park Service, it just warms the cockles of your heart to see this park get the use that it deserves.
Well, it's not just this park, but in so many parks, when you get a half a mile off of the road, you generally leave most people behind. And to see people making the effort to walk for miles on the frozen surface of the lake, dressed in all of their winter gear, you know, the effort that takes is, you know, well, it's truly heartwarming.
Well, how long do you think this ice might last, enough so that people can visit the sea caves?
Well, we hope it's still there right now. We had a big wind event last night, and the wind is still blowing at 35 miles an hour out of the northwest. And it's the wind that we are most fearful of taking the ice shelf away. So we'll be checking the ice conditions later this afternoon, and we hope that we'll be able to reopen for tomorrow and this weekend. But it is definitely a day-to-day event. And even last year when we had huge amounts of ice, the ice caves closed for the season on March 17th. Mm. So it's a very ephemeral thing. You don't want to wait if you want to see them.
And I have to ask a question. Why are they called sea caves? Because I don't think of Lake Superior as the sea. I think of it as a lake.
Well, sea cave is basically the geologic description of this type of a formation. And whether it's on a lake or whether it's along the ocean coast, they're still referred to as sea caves. And many people refer to Lake Superior as being the inland sea. So it fits.
Well, and it certainly is stunning. I'm sure it's quite beautiful in the middle of July when you're in your kayak paddling in and out, but there sure is something about those incredible ice formations.
And we hope that people, once they see them in the wintertime, are inspired to come back and see them in the summer as well.
Neil Houck with the National Park Service at the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore, just 18 miles west of Bayfield, Wisconsin. Neil, thank you for sharing with us.
Glad to be here.
The scientific community largely agrees climate change is here. Yet the public debate over climate change is tremendously polarizing, even toxic. Andrew Hoffman wanted to explore just what causes people to accept or reject the scientific consensus on climate change. The result is his new book, How Culture Shapes the Climate Change Debate. Andy Hoffman is director of the Erb Institute for Global Sustainable Enterprise at the University of Michigan, where he's also a professor of sustainable enterprise. Always good to see you, Andy.
It's good to see you too, Cynthia.
Well, you start the book out by being pretty critical of the traditional academic approach to talking about climate change. Why is that?
It's not just the academic approach to climate change. It's the academic approach to research. We are encouraged. We are given incentives. We get tenure for writing articles, which is very important. I'm not knocking that. But there is no incentive to take all those articles and pull them together and tell the story as a whole. I use the analogy from an article I found in Science Magazine in 1963, where he worried that the field of academic science was going to become a field of brickmakers. We all make little bricks, but no one's building the wall. In this book, I'm trying to bring together all the social science I could find on why people reject the science of climate change, because I think that whole story needs to be told.
From your view, however did this climate change issue become so toxic, mm-hmm. so polarized?
Well, it has become a debate over values. It's really not about science anymore. It's not about CO2 and climate models. When people talk about climate change today, it's become so muddied and so connected with concerns over bigger government, distrust of environmentalists, distrust of democratic politicians, for some people, distrust of science. For some people, climate change even challenges their notion of God. God's in charge out there. We're not that big that we can actually change the global climate. And so these are the elements of the debate that have become conflated with climate change. And there's a whole literature in the social sciences to explain why this happens.
As you point out in your book, How Culture Shapes the Climate Change Debate, more scientific information isn't the answer.
Especially when people connect it to their personal identity. There are numerous variables you can look at to try and sort of determine someone or connect with someone's belief on climate change. Gender, age, income level, education level, these are all the standard demographic variables. But the strongest correlate is political party affiliation. The majority of Republicans do not believe climate change is happening. The majority of Democrats do. There's the smoking gun that this is a cultural debate. Mm-hmm. It's a debate over worldviews. It's not about science at all. I want to caveat that the public debate.
The public debate.
The public debate is about values. The scientific debate has reached a consensus. That is the word that's used by the American Association for the Advancement of Science and the National Academies of Sciences to say that there is a consensus around the idea that climate change is happening.
So here we have scientific consensus, and it is butting heads with public debate.
Yeah, which is natural.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of scientists, a lot of people feel, well, scientists just produce their results, and then people should just accept them and move on. And I kind of look at this book that, you know, scientists produce their results and say this is happening. For the most part, economists are saying, and the answer is a price on carbon. The fields of sociology, psychology, anthropology, they can say, but why do people accept or reject both those conclusions? And they're an important part of the conversation because most people are scratching their head saying, how can this happen? And it really is when we're faced with complex scientific issues or any issue that we don't quite understand, mm-hmm. our emotions kick in first and our reason kicks in second, a distant second. And so very often we'll have a quick emotional reaction and we spend the rest of the time acting more like a lawyer, trying to find ways to support that emotional response. If I hear something from a particular messenger, and I can offer two right now, Fox News or NPR. One of those will create a response in the audience that I'll believe what they say or I don't believe what the other says.
Yes.
Or I could say Rush Limbaugh and Al Gore.
Yeah.
Again, who says it is as important as what's being said. We need to understand the social dynamics of what we call motivated reasoning, that I will look at information and I'll try and find ways to use that to confirm my worldview, and I will resist ideas that challenge that worldview.
I'm talking with Andy Hoffman. His book is How Culture Shapes the Climate Change Debate. He, of course, is director of the Erb Institute for Global Sustainable Enterprise at the University of Michigan. And in your book, you break down four ways that you categorize this distrust. Distrust of the messengers, of the process that created the message, distrust of the message itself, and distrust of the solutions. With all that distrust swirling around, where do we go with all of that?
Well, once you understand where someone's coming from, and it is about trust. You know, science, when it comes out with a conclusion that asks people to change their beliefs and their behavior, they need to trust. You know, I can say I come from an environment where I do trust science. Mm-hmm. I trust that there's something called an atom. It has electrons flying around a nucleus, and this body is made up of billions of these. I'll never see them. I can never prove they exist, yet I trust science because it tells me it's so. But we can't expect everybody to just trust that or trust the conclusions. And so if you can understand the forms of distrust, then you can start to engage the debate to try and deal with those. So distrust of the messengers. We need more messengers that will resonate with people that resist the science. And I pinpoint two of them. We need more messengers from the business community, and we need more messages from the ideological right. They will reach people that people on the ideological left or NGOs cannot reach. people will trust something if it comes from someone that they trust.
And are we seeing, we've talked about this on Stateside, where we are seeing business realize it's to their benefit and it's to the bottom line benefit to deal with climate change and prepare strategies.
I would say some businesses.
Some.
And that's the key.
Yeah.
Climate change for the business community represents a market shift. In any market shift, you're going to have winners and losers. The losers will resist the change. The winners will try and promote it.
And distrust of the solutions. Again, that's a tough one to get past.
Well, yeah. And just think about it. I mean, what do we do? Well, we have a carbon price. Mm-hmm. And then people start to hear more government intrusion in the market. And that's a very resonant debate today. Or you could even take it if you want to really hit the real hot button issue, and we perhaps need to do that globally. Who should do that? Well, maybe the UN. And now you've really hit a hot button. A lot of people are very distrustful of the idea of national sovereignty being intruded on by some kind of global carbon price. How do we frame solutions in a way that represents a future that we all desire, one that addresses both our interests as a collective but also individual rights and individual freedoms that can't be infringed upon? How do we find solutions that walk that line? There's the challenge, and it's a thorny one.
It is a thorny one, and you have this image of our children or our great-grandchildren living with the effects of what science agrees is coming and looking at this point in history, and the idea of Nero fiddling while Rome burns kind of comes to mind.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, the answer is not simply to allow this to devolve into what I call a cultural schism.
If it hasn't already.
Well, I don't think it has. Mm. I think it's getting toxic, but I don't think it has. There is movement. There is some change. I think the Pope coming out and giving an encyclical on environmental issues, whether he mentions or says right out that climate change is happening, I think that is encouraging that a religious leader would come out and say that there's a moral component to this debate. My hope is that his statement may allow some cover for some conservatives who are Catholic or not to say, you know, climate change is real. Look, the Pope did it. And it's not anathema or it's not contradictory to say, I'm a conservative Republican and I think climate change is real.
Meantime, in your book, you tell us 2/3 of Americans rarely, if ever, discuss climate change or global warming with family and friends.
Yes.
What does that tell you?
I'm sure we've all been there, that the topic comes up and the conversation starts to ice over. You start to feel this anxiousness start to emerge. And that, to me, it recognizes the emotionality of the issue. So tread lightly, tread carefully. If you are sitting down with someone who says, I don't believe climate change is happening, don't pull out your PowerPoint slide deck and start to give them a science lecture or start to critique their car or their house. Don't judge them and try and understand where they're coming from.
Yeah, what are the do's?
Yeah, well, first of all, understand where they're coming from and what they're hearing. Don't bring up messengers that they don't trust. Try and find messages they do trust. Frame it in a way that resonates with your audience. When I speak to business audiences, I don't talk about radiative forcing or carbon loading. I talk about consumer demand, operational efficiency, cost of capital. Put it in the language that people can understand. And some of the frames that are being examined within the social science literature are frames around national security. There is a group of Army generals, the CNA group, that said that climate change is a threat multiplier, that it will destabilize regions of the world, and the U.S. military will have to go in and deal with this. Thomas Friedman has been pushing the idea this is an issue of economic competitiveness. If we don't develop the energy technologies of the future, someone else will. We'll buy them. Some people push forward the frame of risk management. You have a low probability, high consequence event. And what do we do about that? Well, we actually all have that in our lives when we buy fire insurance for our home. Mm. The odds of it burning down are low, but I can't take the hit. On climate change, what is that form of insurance? Well, it's investment in technology development, trying to develop behavior change around energy efficiency. Another frame is health. You know, the key here is to really make it salient and personal, and health does that because when you have extreme weather events, think about high temperatures in urban centers, who gets hit the first and the hardest? It's the senior citizens,
sure,
the young
is.
Children. And we can all resonate with that because we have perhaps grandparents or parents or children, and we don't want them to be harmed. And so that health frame seems to work quite well.
Lots of ideas, and you can find out more in the book, How Culture Shapes the Climate Change Debate, by Andrew Hoffman, who, of course, is the professor of sustainable enterprise and director of the Erb Institute for Global Sustainable Enterprise at the University of Michigan. Always a pleasure to talk with you, Andy. Thank you so much.
Same here, Cynthia. Thank you very much.
Still to come, crisis text lines. It's a brave new world, everyone. We're going to hear how one Michigan group is using text messaging to help teens in trouble. That's in 10 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The idea of a teen crisis line isn't a new one, but think about it. When's the last time you've seen a teenager pick up a phone, dial a number, and call someone? That's why teen crisis centers are partnering up with the first and only crisis hotline to conduct its interventions completely and totally by text. It's called CTL Crisis Text Line. Oakland County's Common Ground is now a partner with CTL. Lisa Turbeville is the Resource and Crisis Helpline Manager there at Common Ground. Good to have you with us, Lisa.
Thank you, Cindy. Thank you for having me.
Common Ground, I know I've grown up in Oakland County, has had that phone crisis line going for, what, 40 years now. But, boy, it seems so logical that kids in 1975 had to pick up the phone, kids in 2015 text.
They did. That was the only outlet years ago. We've had our crisis line for over 40 years. We also tried to start a teen line about 15 years ago where we had teen counselors working on the phones, but it never really took off. It hasn't been a big success. So we decided to meet the youth where they are, and that's via text and chat.
Boy, isn't that the truth. So I know with Crisis Text Line, only starting since December 2013, and the only and first crisis hotline to conduct conversations and interventions by text, so you're part of that. You're a partner with them?
Correct. They're based out of New York. We actually started our Common Ground local text line in July of 2012, and since then, it's been a really big success. So we partnered with the National Suicide Prevention Line, and we also partnered with Crisis Text Line out of New York.
What are you seeing? How does texting change the way that a teen might share what's troubling him or her?
What we've seen is that, you know, we can be objective. They feel safe. They're used to communicating that way. They spend 95% of their time communicating via text, so they're safe. It's their comfort zone. We can be objective. Sometimes they're embarrassed to talk to others or ashamed or afraid. So we're able to provide that outlet for them so they can reach out for help, and it's confidential and anonymous, so they like that. Also provides a level of privacy that a phone call can't. And what I mean by that is, when you're texting, they can't overhear. No one can overhear your conversation. It's particularly a good outlet for people who are in a domestic violence situation or in some kind of situation where they need to reach out secretly or privately.
I can only imagine that talking on the phone could make a bad situation even worse if they're overheard.
And also it's mobile. You know, if they're in a situation where they're not safe or they don't feel safe, they can text us. And we can try to intervene and get them help via text so that no one can overhear them.
How does it play out then? You get a text. Give me a for instance.
A lot of our texts have to do with self-harm and suicide and bullying, mental illness. So, for example, a teen will text in and we'll start by asking them, you know, what's going on. And depending upon, you know, what their situation is, we will provide crisis intervention via text. And then we'll try to link them up with resources. If they already have a therapist, you know, we'll encourage them to get in touch with their therapist. If they don't, we can give them resources on where to get help.
Mm-hmm. The thing I'm wondering is there a follow-up? Do you find out if indeed they did? I guess I'm wondering, is there a sense of a completion that perhaps you would get in a phone call? Do things seem to get left hanging by text? Or do you feel it also is a complete intervention?
Well, we certainly try to do a complete intervention. We don't always know the outcome, but we try to. Sometimes we hear back from them. We certainly encourage them to text us again if they ever need us to. And if we do any kind of intervention where we connect them with someone, then we know the outcome. But sometimes we don't.
Yeah. Well, I guess it'd be the same with a phone call.
It is.
Are you finding that more young people are reaching out to you now that you're offering this text option versus what you had with the phone?
Absolutely. In fact, we can't even keep up with the demand. We actually need more volunteers to help. The first year of existence, we had 8,910 text messages, mostly from the age group of 13 to 25. And that's only what we were able to take. We weren't able to take more than that. But certainly, you know, the crisis text line, the national text line, they haven't even reached out across the country, and they just had their 5 millionth text last month. So the need is out there. The demand is out there. and we're just trying to build this program up so we can respond to the need out there.
I'm speaking with Lisa Turberville, who's the Resource and Crisis Helpline Manager at Common Ground in Oakland County. This, I think, Lisa, it demands something of an older generation and some awareness that a text coming from a youngster is as valid as a phone call. And I'm wondering if you could share some maybe good and helpful responses for parents and others in the family to use when a teen texts with a problem or an event or something that has them anxious or depressed. I'm guessing what I hear is the first thing is don't say call me. Don't pick up the phone and try to talk. You should keep the text going.
We do offer to either call them or have them call us as well, call the crisis line directly. But if they prefer to just text, then we just stick with that, however we can help them best. So certainly for parents, you know, I would encourage them to suggest and encourage their kids to utilize the service because we offer support. What's also nice is we're 24 hours a day. You know, they don't have access to their therapists or their school counselors or doctors during the middle of the night. And maybe they don't want to wake their parents or anyone. But they can reach out to us and we'll be there.
Let's say as a parent, you get a text and you want to be helpful. Could you give us some ideas of some do's and don'ts?
Well, definitely, you know, do listen. Do reflect back to them what you're hearing them say so that they know that you're listening. So we like to de-escalate them, let them know that we're here listening to them, that it's a safe place to talk. They can talk to us about anything, that, you know, we will try to link them up with some help. Basically letting them know that they're not alone. We try to normalize what they're going through. So if they're talking about something, we let them know that that could be a common issue. We certainly try to find out who their supports are in their life, who they feel comfortable talking to, whether that's a friend, a neighbor, a school counselor, you know, a coach, whoever they feel safest with. And then we encourage them to share, if they haven't already, share that with that person. And then we try to link them up with services and see if there's something else that they want help out there for. We help them come up with a plan for that night or for the day. So, for example, if they're calling and they feel the urge to self-harm, mm-hmm. We'll talk with them about their feelings and their coping skills and trying to come up with other things that they can do to relieve the pain instead of harming themselves. You know, after that, basically, you know, trying to keep them safe, connect them to what they need, whether it's a personal or professional in their life. And then things that we don't want to do is we certainly don't want to discourage them for using our services. We don't want to turn them away. We don't want them to feel embarrassed to share anything with us. We don't want them to feel scared. So we really want to connect with them and let them know and really thank them for taking the courage to reach out to us because it takes a lot of courage to reach out for help.
I suspect that a parent's first inclination would be if, you know, something happened, like, you know, he broke up with me, to either for a parent to go, well, why, what happened, or else to say, well, that's okay, you didn't even like him.
Right.
Which really, I suspect those are both initial responses that a parent might go to, but probably not the most helpful.
That's why people like going to therapists or crisis centers, because we can be objective. We don't know the boyfriend, you know, that you just broke up with. Your family does. And certainly, sometimes they don't want to talk about it. You know, kids, they think, oh, my mom would never understand. They forget that, you know, their mom dated back in the day, too. So they don't feel comfortable, or they don't have a close relationship, so they don't want to talk about that with them. So they feel comfortable coming to someone else.
How would someone reach out to you? What's the best way to reach out? As you say, you're there 24/7.
Great. And they can reach us at www.commongroundhelps.org. And then through our website, they can also, you know, link to our other services, which also includes chat, which they can do over the computer if they don't want to call or if they can't text.
Fantastic. Lisa Turberville of Common Ground, the Oakland County Crisis Intervention Center, there for over 40 years and now incorporating a chat and text to reach out to teens in need. Thank you so much for talking with us, Lisa.
Thank you, Cindy, and thanks for bringing attention to this much-needed service.
One Michigan teen who reached out to Common Ground via text is Anthony Grappito. Anthony's 19, and when he was 16, he was in crisis and sent a text to Common Ground looking for help. Anthony's here with us now. What was going on then, Anthony?
You know, I was feeling pretty depressed down at the time, you know, dealing with some high school problems and some of my own, you know, mental challenges.
I know you were a varsity wrestler and you were on track for a college scholarship.
Yeah, I was planning on wrestling throughout my entire college career and riding my my funds for college off of that, and I guess that just didn't work out. I got slammed in a match and, you know, I hurt my shoulders and I hurt my head pretty bad. Really, it kind of made me super depressed because I thought that I lost my future, and I just really set my brain off weird where I just couldn't see straight for a while and couldn't think or do anything.
I'm curious, did you talk to anyone around you about that, or were you just trying to work it out on your own?
It was kind of back and forth. There's a lot of memory loss that comes with kind of the traumatization of the whole situation with me. But I do remember that for a while I just tried to kind of get it off on my own. And then from there I went to family members and, you know, had a couple friends try and help me. But, you know, in the end, they really didn't have the tools to be able to, you know, to do, I guess, what Common Ground did for me after that text message.
Well, when did you hear about Common Ground's crisis text line?
They actually did a presentation at our school. Someone came and talked to our school from Common Ground, and then I was able to get the number from there and everything. And that's when I heard about the texting.
And I'm interested, Anthony, why was the idea of reaching out through text more appealing to you versus a phone call?
You know, I feel like it's easier to write things down than it is to speak it sometimes, to where, you know, it feels like you save yourself the embarrassment of going through the situation. And, you know, it doesn't feel as real, I guess, if you're texting as opposed to, if, you know, on the phone and I'm kind of embarrassed to tell someone. But, you know, when you're just texting, it's just kind of words, you know, just on a piece of paper, in this case a phone, to where it was a little bit easier to open up because I didn't have to voice my thoughts. I just had to think them.
So what did you send? You sent a text to them. What was the conversation like?
Like, I don't remember, you know, word for word what the text conversation was. But, you know, I just kind of talking to them that, you know, I was just feeling suicidal that night, and they got me through it. They gave me the tools to kind of help me over. It's not like they called, like, the police and they busted in my door and people tried to stop me, but they gave me the tools and texted me back through it. And, yeah, I don't think I ever, you know, actually used the words I was going to do it, but I think that if that's when they start taking other steps, if you tell them your plan or something. I don't really know how that works.
Sure. Well, what kinds of messages did you get back from them that seemed to work for you? Because clearly it did.
I mean, the gist of the messages were basically that they weren't really asking, you know, what's the matter with me or, you know, what's wrong with me. They seemed very caring. They asked, you know, what happened, you know, were very supportive and gave me, you know, different alternatives that could kind of help me out. Different alternatives from, obviously, you know, harming myself or ending my life. Some of the tools, I guess, that they gave me are, if you need to, like, go for a walk, you know, go upstairs and just, you know, sit with your parents or something like that.
And then what about follow-up? Did they help you find therapy? What kind of follow-up did you get?
I did get a follow-up, and I don't know if it was directly from the crisis center, but my school counselor actually called me down to the office the day after. And like I said, I don't know if this was them or if it was just someone at school who, you know, had known who, you know, that I was going through some kind of thing. But my counselor directed me to Common Ground from there, and I went into kind of an eval, and they gave me a therapist.
And how did that work for you? How are you doing now?
You know, I definitely needed it, you know, someone to talk to. And his name was Brian, and he gave me a lot of tools that helped me get over my, you know, depressive cycles or my, you know, really negative cycles. So he gave me these positive cycles, told me, you know, start cycling positive things into my life. They're going to come back around and keep cycling. So after about 7-8 months of that, I started to feel that I was, you know, able to do it on my own. That's when I went and pursued other goals and made myself a happier person.
Are you at school or you got a career going? What's going on with you now?
I'm actually a professional magician now. I do a couple hundred shows a year around the nation. I carry a really positive message with my show, and I try to kind of uplift people's days. And, you know, a lot of my show is dealing with that kind of stigma of not being able to talk about, you know, if you're sad or talk about if there's something going on with your life because you feel that it's not important or that you can't do it.
So what would you tell, you know, any young person, or any person really, who's feeling overwhelmed or stressed out or even suicidal as you were feeling that night that you texted Common Ground?
Definitely get help. I mean, that's the biggest thing. Yeah, I feel like at that point in time, nothing really matters, and you don't really feel anything, and you just keep pushing. I mean, you use whatever tools you can to help yourself and stay happy, and then if you just keep pushing, I mean, the guy who won the Oscar just told a story about how he had tried to commit suicide as a teen, and now he just throws up stage grabbing an Oscar, you know? I never thought that at 18, if I went on a national tour, I'd book a Vegas show. And, you know, if I would have taken my life, I never would have been able to do that kind of stuff.
And I also heard something that is a strong message for classmates and friends of someone. If you think, because you said you knew that friends, you reached out to friends and friends knew, and perhaps it was a friend of yours who went to the school counselor, and that made a difference, too. So you're saying don't be afraid to go seek help on behalf of your friend.
Yeah. I mean, that's another thing. If you see, you know, telltale signs of depression, or I actually, you know, I've seen many, especially coming from Lake Orion, you know, we have a giant suicide issue and, or had, I believe that
yes.
Hopefully it's calmed down. But, you know, and I think the biggest thing was no one really knew how to help. You know, I mean, a lot of people just say, oh, well, just be happy. Well, you know, it's not that easy. It's, if your brain is sick, it's not like you can just get over the flu.
Sure.
I mean, that really is what it is. You know, your brain is sick, and if you don't take care of it, it's going to destroy itself.
But you certainly have helped us understand that a text message can be more powerful than some people, perhaps parents, might think.
Yeah, I mean, especially because a lot of kids aren't, you know, I wasn't at the time, I wasn't comfortable voicing, you know, my emotions. I wasn't comfortable I wasn't comfortable with all these things. I feel that the texting was much, much greater because, like I said, I could put it down into words without having to speak it, with saving myself, I guess, what I felt at the time, but, you know, the embarrassment, kind of like writing in a diary, how, you know, some teenagers can write all these emotions into a diary, but they couldn't speak them out loud. Kind of the same way. It doesn't make it as kind of intimidating as, you know, calling someone and talking to them.
Anthony, we want to thank you for sharing your story with us and wishing you lots of luck on your career as a magician, because it certainly seems like, as well as working magic for people, you are doing outreach to people.
Yes, I try my best to, you know, help as many people as possible.
It was great to talk with you, Anthony. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you. I really appreciate it.
And we have put crisis text line information on our website. Just head to the stateside link at michiganradio.org. Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark, and our engineer today was Bob Scon. Contributors are Mike Blank, Emily Fox, Haley Hirschman, Mercedes Mejia, and Annie Norris. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.